Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
Right now, what needs to happen is a ceasefire before anything else. What is happening on the ground actually is that the Sudanese people are the ones leading efforts that could have been expected from a government if we had a government that is actually interested in the well-being of the people. The civilians are the ones who are rescuing people who are trapped in risky zones.
At least 420 people have been killed in Sudan. Thousands have been wounded. As fighting continues between rival military factions, as fears of a civil war grow, the United States has evacuated its embassy staff in Sudan. Many other countries have as well. We'll get the latest. Plus, we look at the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to protect access to the abortion pill, at least for now.
Supreme Court stayed an order of the Fifth Circuit that would have limited access to the key abortion drug mifepristone nationwide. It's important to understand the ruling, what it does and doesn't mean, and also to situate it in the broader context of struggles in abortion over in America, not just in the states, but increasingly as there are pushes for national limits or even bans on abortion.
We'll also speak to Jan Egeland, head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, about Sudan, but also about Honduras, where he just made a trip. He's calling on the international community to do more to help the region, where one in three people are in urgent need of aid.
We're now at the outskirts of San Pedro Sula in Honduras, and this is a population that is suffering from all sorts of calamities.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Fighting continues in Sudan, where the UN reports over 420 deaths since April 15th. The U.S. and other nations move quickly to evacuate diplomats as the Sudanese military and the paramilitary rapid support forces fail to adhere to announced ceasefires and fears mount of a full-blown civil war. In the Western Darfur region, doctors say they're overwhelmed treating gun victims, including many children. In the capital, Khartoum, many residents remain trapped with dwindling supplies of food, water, and power as Sudan experiences a near-total collapse of internet and phone service. Many others decided to flee for other parts of Sudan.
When I fled, I left with the clothes on me, without money as I kept them at home. I didn't bring clothes. I didn't bring a backpack. Nothing. If you find a way out, do it. Don't plan to stay in Khartoum. If you think you are safe by staying at your home, you are not.
We'll get the latest on the Sudan conflict after headlines. The U.S. Supreme Court halted a ban and other restrictions on the abortion pill mifepristone Friday, keeping the nation's most popular abortion method available for now, as an appeal of the nationwide ban on the pill plays out. The ban was issued earlier this month by the Trump-appointed right-wing Texas judge Matthew Kaczmarek, who ruled the FDA's 23-year-old approval of the drug was invalid. Justice Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas were the only justices to issue a public dissent in Friday's ruling. The case is still likely to end up in front of the Supreme Court after making its way through a lower appeals court, leading to mounting calls to restructure the nation's highest court. On Friday, New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted, quote, "The court has devolved into a highly politicized entity that's rapidly delegitimizing. Open discussion of checking the court's abuse of power and defying Kaczmarek possibly contributed to pause consideration." AOC and others had called on the federal government to defy the Texas judge's order. Arguments in the challenge to the mifepristone ban are scheduled for May 17th. Former Peruvian President Alejandro Toledo has been extradited from the U.S. to Peru, where he faces charges of corruption and money laundering while in office from 2001 to 2006. Toledo is accused of receiving millions of dollars in bribes from Brazilian construction conglomerate Odebrecht in exchange for public work contracts. Toledo was taken into custody last week and arrived in Lima yesterday. He's denied the accusations. In Kenya, authorities have exhumed the bodies of 47 followers of a Christian cult who apparently starved themselves to death. Investigators say Pastor Paul Mackenzie Ntenge convinced members of the Good News International Church they would go to heaven if they stopped eating. Police say they've rescued over a dozen members of the cult from starvation, only to have them continue to refuse food. Most of the bodies exhumed so far were of women and children. Burkina Faso's military government is blaming fighters affiliated with al-Qaeda and the Islamic State for an attack on Thursday that killed 60 civilians near the border with Mali. Survivors said more than 100 people on motorcycles and pickup trucks arrived in their village dressed in military uniforms before targeting dozens of men and young people. Conflict in Burkina Faso has killed tens of thousands of people and displaced about 2 million since 2015. In Mexico, thousands of asylum seekers are marching from the southern state of Chiapas to Mexico City, protesting abuse and demanding immigration jails be shut down. This comes nearly a month after the deadly fire at an immigration jail at the U.S.-Mexico border. This is an asylum seeker from Honduras.
We're protesting the 40 deaths in Ciudad Juarez to demand the closure of the National Migration Institute, to demand President Obrador pays attention to us because ours is a good cause, to demand the removal of the migration director because these migrant centers are the concentration camps and bunkers of this century.
The majority of victims of the fire were indigenous people from Guatemala. Last week, about two dozen makeshift tents at a migrant camp in Matamoros across the border from Texas were set ablaze. Asylum seekers stuck in Mexico due to harsh U.S. immigration policies have long denounced human rights violations, including torture at the hands of organized crime and Mexican authorities. Mississippi's Republican Governor Tate Reeves signed legislation Friday expanding Mississippi's control over law enforcement in the black-majority capital city of Jackson. The legislation, approved by Mississippi's majority-white Republican-led state legislature, grants the Capitol Police greater authority over much of Jackson without being accountable to local leaders or residents. It creates a separate court system for Jackson composed of judges appointed directly by white state officials. A lawsuit filed by the NAACP seeking to block the law from taking effect warns it will create separate and unequal policing. In Atlanta, Georgia, Rashida Williams, also known as Coco Dadal, the star of the award-winning documentary Kokomo City about the lives of a group of black trans sex workers, was fatally shot last week. The 35-year-old is the latest victim in a wave of violent attacks against trans women in Atlanta following the April 11th murder of Ashley Burton and a shooting in January that left another trans woman in critical condition. Meanwhile, in Maryland, a transgender woman is suing Maryland's Department of Corrections after she was improperly held in a jail for men where she was sexually assaulted and denied medical treatment. According to the federal lawsuit, Chelsea Gilliam, who is black, was then transferred to another facility and placed in solitary confinement for 3 months. She was in custody from December 2021 to May 2022 and says she continues to suffer from anxiety and depression. President Biden's expected to announce his bid for re-election as early as Tuesday, which will mark 4 years since he announced his candidacy for the 2020 presidential election. He's reportedly tapped Julie Chavez Rodriguez to run his 2024 campaign. Chavez Rodriguez was Biden's deputy campaign manager in 2020, currently the director of the White House Office of Intergovernmental Affairs. She's the granddaughter of the labor leaders Cesar Chavez and Helen Favela Chavez. President Biden signed an executive order establishing an Office of Environmental Justice within the White House. Biden unveiled his plan at a ceremony in the Rose Garden Friday.
Environmental justice will be the mission of the entire government, woven directly into how we work with state, local, tribal, and territorial governments. This is an order that directs the federal agencies to address gaps in science and technology. For example, there's a lot we still don't know about the quality of people's wastewater or the air they're breathing.
Environmental groups welcome the announcement, but caution that Biden remains a major supporter of fossil fuels, having approved drilling projects on federal land faster than Trump did during his first 2 years in office. The Center for Biological Diversity said in a statement, quote, if the president wants to distinguish himself from oily Republicans, let's see him reverse the Willow Project, stop approving massive Gulf drilling and gas exports, and phase down public lands drilling, they said. The United Nations warns in a new report that record levels of heat-trapping greenhouse gases led to planetary-scale changes on land, at sea, and in the atmosphere last year. The World Meteorological Organization stated the Global Climate Report released on Earth Day found the years 2015 to 2022 were the eight warmest on record, despite the cooling impact of La Niña over much of that period. Antarctic sea ice fell to its lowest extent on record. Glaciers retreated at an accelerating pace, and ocean heat content reached a new record high last year. The WMO warns sea level rise due to human activity is set to continue for millennia. The Environmental Protection Agency is preparing to announce limits on greenhouse gas emissions from power plants in a bid to cut one of the main sources of U.S. air pollution by 2040. The new rules reportedly would force power plants to capture carbon dioxide emissions from their smokestacks or use other methods to eliminate nearly all carbon dioxide emissions by 2040. And activists around the world marked Earth Day Saturday with marches and other actions drawing attention to the climate crisis. In the UK, Extinction Rebellion, Greenpeace, and other groups organized 4 days of protests under the banner of the Big One, which included a massive rally and a die-in outside London's Parliament. This is an air quality researcher and climate activist speaking from one of this weekend's actions.
We're in one of the busiest streets of London. The air pollution created from this and the agriculture ammonia is creating a spring haze over London. Now, all of this comes from meat and dairy and fossil fuels. Now, what the government are not doing is taking either of those two things into account, trying to reduce either of those two things. Instead, they're trying to get over 100 new oil and gas licenses, which are incompatible with a 1.5 degree warming world.
Smaller rallies took place across the United States and Washington, D.C. Activists marched to the White House to demand an end to the nation's reliance on fossil fuels. Elsewhere, the German climate group Last Generation organized a slow march through Berlin, causing gridlock in parts of the city. The same group, known for its acts of disruption, shut down dozens of traffic junctions in Berlin today by gluing their hands to the streets, including in the middle of a major highway. An activist from Last Generation, which is calling for Germany to stop using all fossil fuels by 2030, said, quote, we're bringing the city to a standstill so the government moves. And in France, thousands of people in the southern Tarn region marched to protest a proposed new highway and built a cement brick wall in the middle of a national road to oppose the project. Locals say the highway would increase pollution and threatens the area's biodiversity. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at the crisis in Sudan, where fighting between rival military factions has killed at least 420 people and injured close to 4,000 since April. Over the weekend, U.S. Special Forces flew into Khartoum to evacuate U.S. Embassy staff. Many other nations evacuated diplomats as well as their citizens as fear grows the fighting could lead to a civil war in Africa's third largest country by size. The Sudanese military and the paramilitary rapid support forces have been fighting each other since April 15th. The fighting's dashed hopes of a return to civilian rule in Sudan. CNN is reporting the Russian mercenary group Wagner has backed the RSF by providing surface-to-air missiles. The head of the Wagner group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, has denied CNN's report, but on Friday he offered to act as a mediator between the two sides. In Sudan, Sudan's capital, Khartoum, many residents remain trapped with dwindling supplies of food, water and power as Sudan experiences a near total collapse of internet and phone service. The World Food Program's warning the fighting could plunge millions more people into hunger in Sudan. This is a Nigerian student stranded in Khartoum.
Since there is no electricity, there is no water. I was having some little water left with me. I've been managing the water. I cannot, for 2 days, I can't shower. There is no water to drink. There is no food to drink. You cannot go out to the street to buy food. There is nothing you can buy. And even the cash is not there.
Doctors Without Borders recently reported up to 70% of the hospitals in Khartoum and neighboring states are not able to function. This is Esra Abu Shama, a doctor at Sudan's health ministry.
Well,
most of the big and specialized hospitals are out of service and not offering any services of examination or treatment services for the patients because they have been targeted with shelling, and some of them because of the shortage of doctors and also because of electricity and water outages.
We're joined right now by Khalid Mustafa Madani, an associate professor of political science and Islamic studies, chair of the African Studies program at McGill University. He's joining us from Montreal. Thank you so much for being with us. We had hoped to also have a guest in Khartoum, but it looks like there's almost a complete internet as well as cellular service shutdown in Sudan, so we have not been able to reach them. Professor Madani, can you describe the situation? We've been talking about it being near a civil war. Is it in the midst of a civil war right now?
I wouldn't categorize it as a civil war because that would suggest that you have a collection of people, a group of people fighting another. This is essentially a power struggle, really, between General Abdel Fattah Burhan, the general of the standing army, and as you noted in your report, in your introduction, the head of a paramilitary militia, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. So, unfortunately, the civilians are held hostage. So it's not so much a civil war, but essentially a fight to the death between two generals who have been partners and allies in the past. The consequences, unfortunately, for a city, the capital city that is houses approximately 8 to 10 million people, is unprecedented in terms of the catastrophe, as your reporting has shown. It's not only that there are over 500 people that have perished. That's, of course, probably clearly an underestimation. But the humanitarian consequences in this city, basically the infrastructure has completely collapsed. It's not just that the supplies of food are not there, but also people are generally trying to flee the city, and most cannot. But thousands are fleeing northwards towards Egypt or towards the Red Sea. In the east, there are also clashes in the western province of Darfur. Sudanese there are fleeing to Chad across the borders. This is unprecedented in terms of the kind of violence that has really the capital city has witnessed. So I would really categorized it less as a civil war, as a basically a conflict of between two generals who are basically trying to take over political control over the country.
And explain what prompted this latest conflict. Give us a brief history of Sudan.
Yes, absolutely. I think for your viewers, it's important to understand that these two generals had conspired and were partners in upending the very fragile coalition government in October 2021 that had been set up after the historic revolution of 2019, where millions of Sudanese took to the streets, not only in the capital of Khartoum, but throughout the country, that overthrew 30 years of an Islamist authoritarian dictatorship under the rule of the former president Omar Bashir. After that revolution, there was a coalition government that was supposed to oversee the country to transition towards a civilian democracy and elections that would consolidate that. But on October 2021, both of these generals, one was the head of the army and his deputy was actually now is the head of these militias, Dagalo, decided basically to wage a coup to upend that democratic experiment or the transition to democracy. Following that, protests in Sudan continued. The will of the Sudanese people with respect to continuing on the road to a full civilian democracy continued, forcing and compelling these two generals to actually get back to the table with civilian politicians and iron out what was called a framework agreement under the auspices of the international community, the Quad. The actors from the international community included the United States, the United Kingdom, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. That framework agreement was supposed to restart and revitalize this transition to a civilian democracy. But there were three essential contentious issues that really have sparked this particular conflict. One of them had to do with the issue of accountability, that is transitional justice, the accountability on part of both these generals, because on the one hand, Hemeti had been accused of violence in the Darfur region. He was responsible for really thousands of civilians in Darfur, putting down that insurgency in the 2000. And Burhan himself, who cooperated with that, but also both of them actually repressed the activist on the street. In June of 2019, both of them and their forces essentially killed over 100 activists that had been in a sitting trying to energize this revolution. And another issue was the dismantling of the economic empire that had been built by the former regime, overseen now by Burhan, and also dismantling the vast wealth that that Hemeti, the militia leader, had really amassed through the smuggling of gold, cooperation with the Wagner Corporation, and also sending mercenaries to the war in Yemen. These were two essential kind of contentious issues. But the one that really sparked this conflict was an issue over integrating the paramilitary militia into the standing army. That is really where the dispute emerged, leading to this horrible conflict. On the one hand, General Burhan had wanted the paramilitary militia to be integrated within the course of 2 years, very quick integration, after which he could consolidate his rule over the military establishment. On the one hand, Hemeti or Dagalu, the head of the paramilitary militia, wanted this to happen over the course of 10 years, essentially basically rejecting integrating his paramilitary forces into the National Standing Army. It is at that point that both decided or calculated that they had to actually defeat their rival. Quickly, Dagalu, the head of the paramilitary militia, began mobilizing even more forces in Khartoum and throughout the neighborhoods of the capital city, and also attacking an airport in Marwi in northern Sudan. That mobilization is what led Burhan to utilize the forces of the National Army to try to eliminate his rival. Essentially, both of them now are in a battle to the death. They conceive it as a zero-sum game. The Sudanese population throughout the country is held hostage to the ambitions, the political and economic ambitions of these two generals. So it's not a civil war. It really is, unfortunately, the kind of result of this kind of greed for power and their interest in maintaining their vast economic assets and empire, both built in the course of the previous regime.
You see that this could become a proxy war. I mean, you have Dagalo, also known as Hemeti, what he was in Moscow on the day that Russia invaded Ukraine. You talk about him getting support for the RSF forces from the Wagner group, the Russian group. And, of course, then you have the United States there clearing out its embassy staff, about 100. There are still 16,000 Americans. Italy clearing out both its citizens and its staff. Saudi Arabia doing the same. Talk about the significance of all of this. And is this also a fight over resources, as you mentioned, gold?
Yes, absolutely. Well, it is. There is no question that it'll. There's a very good chance, unfortunately, that it would devolve into a proxy war because these two generals had already been utilized as proxies by certain powers. In the case of Hemeti, there is absolutely no question that the Wagner Corporation or the mercenaries of Wagner had helped in amassing the gold, and that was smuggled not only to Russia eventually, but the majority of it actually to the United Arab Emirates, the markets in Dubai. That's very important. As I said, he also served in the past as a mercenary, being sent to Yemen at the behest in support of Yemen, of Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates in that war. Another very important aspect of Hemeti is that he does have close link with the Haftar, Khalifa Haftar of the Libyan National Army, who had also supported him. Hemeti had also sent soldiers from his paramilitary militia to Libya to fight under Haftar in that war in 2019. Many of them have returned, however. That is with respect to Hemeti. With respect to Burhan, his links with Egypt are very, very strong. Sisi in Egypt supports him because he's very much opposed to a democratic evolution in Sudan, but also deeply concerned about Egypt's interest with respect to the Nile waters. What I want to emphasize in terms of answering your question in this context is the strategic location of Sudan. I think many people are unaware how important it is located. It not only borders the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean, which is so important. Russia historically has really wanted to have a naval base there and had been working out an agreement to do so. That, of course, is a great concern to the United States and, of course, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. So there's a scramble for control over the strategic location of the port in Sudan on the Red Sea. Sudan also, of course, shares the Nile waters with Egypt and Ethiopia. Those two countries, as you probably know, have been in conflict and in tension over the establishment of the Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Egypt in particular has been concerned. South Sudan, for those viewers who may not be aware, does have a great deal of oil. It exports to China, but that oil has to go through a pipeline in Sudan. That becomes really important. So the strategic location of Sudan is the main reason that there's a great danger of this conflict not only destabilizing Sudan, which it has, of course, in the capital city and throughout the country, but the entire region, as the different actors understand, and they are very quickly, that their own strategic interest and their conflicts with their rivals may actually be undermined if Sudan's stability completely evaporates.
On Friday, Sudan's top general, the de facto ruler Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, made his first public remark since the fighting broke out.
There remains hope that we are with our great people, and we will overcome this tribulation and emerge from it unified, strong, and coherent. And our slogan will only get stronger. One army, one people.
In his speech, General al-Burhan claimed Sudan's military is committed to a transition to civilian rule, even though he led the coup 18 months ago that toppled Sudan's civilian Prime Minister, Abdullah Hamdok. If you can talk about that, and then we'll talk about, as you said, this isn't a civil war. It's a war between two militaries and what is happening to the people, including your own family.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that's signaling that both of them, it's not only Burhan, but also even more so Hemeti or Dagalo, have insisted that they're fighting for democracy, ironically, that they're fighting for democracy and to return Sudan to that path towards a transition, towards a civilian democracy. And that, of course, is simply on their part propaganda to the international community. But even more importantly, I'd like to emphasize the reason that they also stating that on both their parts is because of the sheer resilience of the Sudanese population that in their unanimity continue, despite what is going on, to insist that the Sudan's future must be predicated on a transition to a full civilian government. The reason they're both making these statements is not only to gesture to the international community and to generate their support. After all, the international community had committed themselves until recently, until this conflict emerged, to oversee and help support Sudan towards a transition to a civilian democracy. But neither of these generals, and this is why I'm not calling it a civil war, despite the severity of the conflict, neither of them have a constituency among Sudanese. On the one hand, Hemeti Dagalo is relying almost exclusively on mercenaries that he has paid or pays out of his out of the smuggling of gold and his vast wealth, and of course utilizing them as mercenaries. And on the other hand, Burhan is really the head, not so much of the armed forces, but the top brass of the armed forces that are in Sudan, referred to as remnants of the former Islamist regime of Omar Bashir, the National Congress Party. So on the part of Burhan, his only constituency is a very limited group of people who are fighting as much as they can, in this case, at the cost of the Sudanese people, in order to retain the vast wealth of the deep state that the Islamist authority.